The views and opinions expressed on this show are purely the views and opinions of the person who made them, and do not necessarily reflect or agree with those of the show's commercial sponsors, its radio station affiliates, or internet broadcast platforms. As the restriction on our God-given right to free speech manifests itself throughout the world, we are inspired by Jesus Christ's immortal words, "And ye shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free." And we reserve the rights to all our words. Thank you, and now enjoy the show.
To learn who rules over you, simply find out who you are not allowed to criticize. You are listening to ACH. I'm Andy, your host. Good morning and welcome to today's inaugural episode of Andrew Carrington Hitchcock Presents, originally recorded and broadcast on Saturday, August the 29th, 2026, at andrewcarringtonhitchcock.com. Today's episode is entitled The Films of Stanley Kubrick. The time is 7:44 over here in London, England, and it is nice to be presenting new content for you again. Okay, so the way that this came about is I had a box set some years ago that's widely available on Stanley Kubrick. It starts off with Dr. Strangelove, which I believe is 1964, and goes all the way through to his last film, Eyes Wide Shut, was that 98. And then I saw another box set called Kubrick, the Masterpiece Collection, with a book in it, and it also started off with the film that preceded Dr. Strangelove, and that was Lolita from 1962, so I bought that. That was black and white, as was Dr. Strangelove. I'm not a big fan of black and white films, unless, of course, it's Laurel and Hardy, which I have on DVD. Most of them have the option to watch the colourised version, which I can honestly say I've never even attempted to do, because I know it would distort from the original black and white that I so well remember. But that being said, black and white works for me with Laurel and Hardy, but not necessarily with other films. Films that have tried it, Raging Bull, for example. I remember a friend of mine who was a film studies student telling me that the reason Martin Scorsese had shot Raging Bull in black and white was he was so proud of it. He wanted it to be retained in its natural state. But I heard Martin Scorsese talking on an interview about it, and he was talking about how Thelma Schoonmaker, his longtime editor, she was married to an English filmmaker, Michael someone or other, I believe, who was a lot older than her. And he was looking at Raging Bull with Martin Scorsese when he was doing the film. And he said there's something not right about De Niro's gloves, and they were red. And Scorsese suddenly worked out what he meant. He said, oh, he meant the film should be shot in black and white. It doesn't look right in colour, a film of that period. And that was why he did it. But I would like to have seen the film in colour, and I believe I would probably have re-watched it a lot more than I have if it was in colour. The reason I say that is because the films that preceded Lolita by Stanley Kubrick were all in black and white, bar one. We'll go through them one by one. And I never had any interest in really looking at them. I might have looked them up and thought, that doesn't really interest me, and what have you. But I was in a charity shop and I saw a copy of Paths of Glory for 50p a few weeks ago, and I recognised the title as being a Kubrick film. I thought, you've got to buy this. You've got to have a look at it. Black and white, what have you. Then I saw a copy of Spartacus, which is another Kubrick film, which is actually in colour. So he did Paths of Glory, black and white, Spartacus colour, and then you had Lolita and Dr. Strangelove, both black and white, before he went to colour with 2001 in 1968. And that left me with three films that preceded Paths of Glory, out of the 13 that I believe he made. I found the first one was actually in public domain, and I shared that on a show post recently. It's called Fear and Desire. And then there were only two left, because you can find that Fear and Desire on YouTube. And I ordered, they were in a double pack on Blu-ray, which I ordered. And then the supplier never arrived, and I emailed the supplier, oh, well, it's circumstances beyond our control. I'm not putting up with this. If you haven't got the item, don't take my money. So that's it. Refund. Got the refund. And then a couple of weeks later, well, let's try ordering it from someone else. I'll just have to wait if there's a problem. I really want to finish this set off. Because, yeah, there are some filmmakers out there. Like, if you were going to go for a Roger Corman, who used to bring a film out every couple of weeks, you know, he was where a lot of people got their start. Martin Scorsese did a Roger Corman film called Boxcar Bertha in 1962. Francis Ford Coppola did a Roger Corman film in Dementia 13, I think, in 1963. Many top people who went on to become big directors got their start with Roger Corman. Many actors, like Jack Nicholson, got their start in Roger Corman films because he was so prolific as a producer in the content that he would put out. So if you were to do his filmography, you'd be there for ages. But when you've got someone who's a director who's done 13 films and you've already seen most of them, if they sort of turn up here and there, it's not a big stretch to try and look at them all. And even if you're not that interested in the content that they're covering, you do feel a sense of achievement at the end of it to say, you know what, I actually saw all this guy's body of work and I'm pleased I did. I won't necessarily go back to certain things. I have a friend who, on the subject of collecting, I mean, collecting with a purpose, not buying stickers for a Panini sticker album that most people never finished, that you keep having to buy the same ones over and over again because you can't see what's in the packet. I mean, that must have been a real racket for the people that owned that over the years, mustn't it? The amount of money that they made on that. But a friend of mine, he did a project which was to visit every one of the 92 football grounds, professional football grounds, because there's a lot of amateur sides, in England. So not including Scotland, but in England and Wales. That covers Wales as well, but not Northern Ireland and Scotland. And it took him a period of years because some of these things might be easy. He lived in London, so when he started off with the London clubs, he could just get a train over on match day, watch it, come home. But there were others. We went to Blackpool together at one point to, you know, go up there for a, you know, when they used to go for a, we were meeting some friends up there we'd met on holiday and stuff like that. And he did Fleetwood while we were up in Blackpool, a football club, which was a lower league football club. But, you know, if you just do that, it's like 300 miles from London. You've really got to be going up the day before, staying over, watching the game, staying over, come back on the Sunday. So you imagine the amount of clubs you have to cover to do 92. And at the end result is that you've achieved a goal. You've covered all of them. And the way that that works is if any club during that time builds a new ground, you have to, that gets knocked off your list and you have to do it again. And then you have to keep up with the clubs that do end up replacing their ground, moving to a bigger ground, that sort of thing. So going back, as I always digress, to the films of Stanley Kubrick, I just want to stress the importance of collecting can be fun. It can involve effort, but when you put the effort in to get something like that out of it, you think of the additional things that this friend of mine got. He's probably seen more places in the country that I'll ever see by doing these football grounds. But people need to identify ways that they can spend their spare time in a productive manner. And some people may not believe watching the films of Stanley Kubrick is a productive use of one's spare time. But nevertheless, that is what I did. So let's go over to what I use Wikipedia primarily for, and that is looking up things like films, music, stuff like that. So they have a Wikipedia page on Stanley Kubrick. I'm at the filmography section. There is another subheading below that which takes you to a dedicated Wikipedia page on Stanley Kubrick's filmography, but I don't want to look at more extensive details. I just want to go through the list. So 1952, his first film, Fear and Desire. Now, that film, what's it about? Well, it's black and white, like I said. He had friends of the family finance it, never made its money back, apparently. And it's difficult to know really what it's about. You've got two groups of soldiers somewhere in some conflict, and some woman gets captured by one of them, group and tied to a tree, and it's all very monotonous and boring. Then they hole up in a shed or the building somewhere and things like that. Kubrick tried to buy the negative, the rights to it, to destroy it, because he didn't want to be associated with the film, because he said it was amateurish. It was something he did, you know, early on, 1952, and he hated it and tried his best to prevent people from seeing it. But people still had copies around the world, so it became difficult for him to do. And it's probably another reason why it fell into public domain, because he wasn't keen to exercise any rights over it. I haven't gone into the intricacies of it. You can watch it for yourself for free on YouTube. There are two versions I saw on there. The one that I shared was, it had an intro with a little write-up about the background and what have you to the film, which was quite interesting, and the picture quality was quite good. So it's out there if you want to see it. Next, we have Killer's Kiss, which is available on a Blu-ray double with the following film, The Killing. So The Killing is the title film of the Blu-ray, but Killer's Kiss is available as an extra on that Blu-ray. So Killer's Kiss, he made in 1955, and he regards that as his first proper film. It's only short, just over an hour, 67 minutes. And you've kind of got two stories going on. You've got a boxer, who's a somewhat washed up boxer, and he's going off for a fight where he pretty much knows he's going to get knocked out. He's just there as, you know, cannon fodder or whatever they call it in boxing. And then you've got a woman who's working at a club as some sort of waitress type thing, you know. She's being pursued by the boss of that club and keeps having to rebuff his unwanted advances. And this boxer and this woman, they live in apartment complexes opposite to each other. Excuse me. And the boxer, one evening, he's looking over at her because he's quite besotted by this woman, and he sees this club owner in there trying to strangle her in the apartment. So he goes in and, frightens this guy off and ends up befriending her, and they become friends and embark on some sort of romance over a couple of days, in which time he gets embroiled in some dispute with the club owner and his thugs, because he's obviously into organized crime and stuff like that. And that's pretty much how the story goes. It's a bit pointless. It's not my favorite story. It's not a real clock watcher because it's a short film. Again, I'm pleased I saw it, but I don't think I'll ever be going back to it again. So that was Killer's Kiss from 1955. And then we've got The Killing, which many people, even Quentin Tarantino, said it was inspired Reservoir Dogs, because this is a heist movie. And you've got a group of people. You've got the first sort of leading actor that Kubrick's used that I've heard of, Sterling Hayden. Get that right, Sterling Hayden. Now, Sterling Hayden, I'd only known from, I think he was a big actor in his time, but I only know him from being the corrupt cop in The Godfather, who Michael Corleone shoots after he gets the gun from behind the toilet in the restaurant. That's Sterling Hayden. But that was Sterling Hayden in 1972, and this is Sterling Hayden in 1956, 16 years beforehand. And he plays the lead role, and he's a guy who's been released from prison. He assembles a team of unlikely criminals to play their part in robbing a racetrack when they've got a big horse race on, and then getting away. And it's basically what happens, how the plan comes together, how the plan is executed, and the outcome. And the way I want to present this, it's, I don't want to tell you everything about it in case you want to see it, because I'm one of these people that if I see a post for a show, most of the time I won't want to read it because I don't want to know what happens. And that's why when I do the only real descriptive post I do for shows these days is the shows that I do with Dr. Peter Hammond, and I try and whet your appetite for what's in there without necessarily giving the full game away. Excuse me, my throat's going again, just a little cough and a drink of water. So I want to outline what goes on, and then you can check it out if you would like for yourself. So that is The Killing, Stanley Kubrick's second proper film, third film in the catalogue, from 1956. And then we go on to what I consider probably his first good film. And that was 1957's Paths of Glory. Now, this was the one I picked up for 50p in a charity shop. Again, it's not the longest film in the world. This is 88 minutes, and I tend to like films that come in around the hour and a half mark. There are so many films that drag on and on and on, over 2 hours, stuff like that. And you think to yourself, this could have been so much shorter, and it would have been punchier and better. But I guess when, you know, John Lennon once said that he hates leaving things in the can. He likes to get out everything that he recorded. And I imagine as a filmmaker, you really, yeah, if you were prepared to go to the time and trouble of setting up a scene, of scripting it, storyboarding it, paying for it, all these sorts of things, then inevitably you're going to want to use it. And I think that that's where the job of a good editor comes in, to, you know, really dictate what should and should not be in the film to make it an enjoyable watch. But Paths of Glory, what I'm reminded of, well, firstly, the background to this story is, it was quite controversial at the time because it was an anti-war film. And it's one of these films that's been selected for preservation in the United States National Film Registry. You know, that doesn't necessarily, it's a bit like films that win an Oscar. They're not necessarily the best films, are they? But when I think of Paths of Glory, I think of Kirk Douglas, the lead actor, walking around the trenches in the World War and having this overhead shot of him walking round, and also a shot in front of him. And this is pre-Steadicam days, so it obviously wasn't that easy to do, but it's very striking. Essentially what happens is he's quite senior. Is he a general or something like that, or a major or something? But he's in charge of a lot of soldiers in a trench. And he gets a superior officer who's very gung-ho, and he wants to get these officers out into no man's land, even though Kirk Douglas has said, look, these people are just going to get killed. And he says, well, if they won't go, I'm going to shoot them for cowardice, you know. And that's consequently the ones that survive, that's what he does. And Kirk Douglas stands up for them, and there's all sorts of shenanigans on with the top military brass and things like that, back and forth. And that's really what the story is about. It's not one that I would necessarily go back to, but again, I'm pleased I saw it, so it's certainly one that I could recommend watching. And I understand many people find this to be a quite enjoyable film, and it's certainly regarded as one of Kubrick's. When you hear Paths of Glory, for example, that's why I just saw it, just that Paths of Glory, and you had to pick it up to find out who the director was, but instantly I thought, Paths of Glory, that's Kubrick, so very much associated with him. The other interesting thing in Paths of Glory, and one of his earlier films, The Killing, that I mentioned, is the actor Joe Turkle is the only is he the only actor to have appeared in three of Kubrick's films? He appeared in The Killing, he appeared in Paths of Glory, and he was the barman in The Shining. So that's a big 23-year gap between Paths of Glory in 1957 and The Shining in 1980. I know Philip Stone, the English actor, he played the protagonist Malcolm McDowell's father in A Clockwork Orange. He also popped up in 1975's Barry Lyndon, and again he was the infamous Grady in The Shining. But let's go back to Paths of Glory. So Joe Turkle, as I say, was in that. And actually, I think I've pretty much wrapped up Paths of Glory, haven't I? So let's go over to the next film, which I believe that is Spartacus. Now, I do not like these old Roman-type films. Ben-Hur, Spartacus, anything with a chariot in it, count me out. I mean, Gladiator came out. There was all this talk about it, a modern film like that. What was it, the year 2000? Never interested me at all. During the lockdown, I ended up watching it because, like many people, I was searching for things to do in the lockdown. And I started watching things that people were telling me were wonderful. So I've got a box set of the Planet of the Apes films, the remakes with Andy Serkis in. And I have to say, the way he played the role was very, very good. But I've seen them once and I think that they're going to go back to a charity shop. I've just been holding on to them because it's a Blu-ray box set that wasn't the most expensive thing in the world. I think it was about £10 or £15. But I bought it new. It's in good condition. And do I want to give it away? Because it's one of these boxes that they've done quite well. It's not much bigger than a normal Blu-ray that you would buy because they've packed all the discs tightly together. But Gladiator, another film, that the Hunger Games trilogy, I looked at those and I'm kind of pleased I saw those just because Philip Seymour Hoffman, I think one of them was end up being his last film, even though he had sort of small roles in that. Not bad films, but again, not been encouraged to go back to again. So Gladiator I looked at, and I was pleased I made the decision in 2000, whenever it came out, not to bother seeing it, and disappointed that I'd chosen to see it when I did during the lockdown. For some reason, I have this just disinterest in Roman times, Roman era. It might go back to, excuse me, being at school and doing the, I had to do Latin at school, for goodness sake, and that was terrible, and Ecce Romani were the textbooks we had to look at, Marcus and Sextus and all this sort of stuff, and maybe it gives me the heebie-jeebies going back to that and having to do Latin homework and all this sort of thing and thinking, why am I learning all this about a dead language, why am I devoted this time? But Spartacus, most famous for the line, I am Spartacus, which incidentally, the film was written by Dalton Trumbo, who was one of the people blacklisted for the so-called Red Scare, you know, one of these so-called communist sympathiser people in Hollywood. And there's a scene where the Roman soldiers are looking for Spartacus because they're after him. He's been this gladiator who's kind of got away from them and risen up an army against Rome. And when the soldiers come to get him, someone else says, I'm Spartacus, and loads of people keep standing up saying, I'm Spartacus. And apparently this was done as a metaphor for people in Hollywood defending those who were accused of communism by all saying that they were communists, so that there were so many of them that they couldn't, you know, arrest them all type of thing. It was, let's all stand in solidarity with these people because it doesn't matter about political affiliation. Hollywood is about movies, it's about art, it's about this sort of thing, and what your politics are is irrelevant. Well, if you look at the sort of things that Hollywood churns out, you can be the judge of whether they're supposed to be entertainment or whether they're supposed to influence your thinking and your actions, and just go from there. That's a debate that's been going on for years, whether television and films actually influence behaviour and thought, or whether they are just entertainment. But Spartacus was in colour. I did watch it. The other interesting thing about Spartacus is it's a film that Kubrick does not recognise as his own, for a different reason. Fear and Desire, his first film that he tried to get destroyed so no one could ever see it. It was because it was amateurish, it was a student film, it's not particularly good, as I said. But Spartacus was the only film he didn't have full creative control over. He was the director, but Kirk Douglas, who actually brought him in, was the producer as well as the actor. And he got a lot of things put in there that Kubrick didn't want. And he had pull because he was the producer. And consequently, Kubrick does not regard that as necessarily a Kubrick canon film, but like Fear and Desire, it is included in his filmography. From there we go on, that was 1960, we go on to 1962, Lolita, which is the first film in the Kubrick Masterpieces box set, purple and black, long box set, which also contains a book, which isn't particularly special, and a print of, I believe, a Kubrick painting, which I won't be hanging on the wall, put it that way. But anyway, Lolita is an adaptation of the Vladimir Nabokov book about a man who marries a woman simply to get access to her 14-year-old daughter, so it's a very unsavoury subject. It's not something like that. It's most famous for James Mason saying, "Oh, Lolita." It's also got, I believe, Peter Sellers in it playing another character who's after Lolita. Filmed in 1962, so you were very limited in what you could do with such a distasteful subject matter. It was refilmed in 1997 by, I believe it's Adrian Lyne. It was far they could do more with it then. It was very well acted. I remember a friend of mine, because Jeremy Irons played the lead role in that, and a friend of mine told me at work, he said, I saw that film, that Jeremy Irons, he needs every award going for the way he played that character and what have you. And he acted it very well. But again, I like Jeremy Irons as an actor, but I haven't seen most of his films because they're on topics I'm really disinterested in, you know? And that's why I mentioned before, there are certain directors, you're just not going to see everything that they've done, because if they're very prolific and they put out a lot of content and there's, you know, films about, I'll give you an example, Oliver Stone did a film called Any Given Sunday with Al Pacino. It's got a lot of other top stars in, but it's about American football. I've got no interest in American football. I don't know the rules. I don't know anything about it. Why am I going to watch that? But if that was the only of one or two of his films that I didn't see, I probably would watch it. But he's in another one called Alexander, which again, that goes back to what? Is that Roman times again? Something like that. It's old, isn't it? It's not the sort of thing that really interests me. I used to think that I don't like films that are set outside of my lifetime. And that's not necessarily true, but there are very few exceptions to that. So it kind of proves the rule, really. I need something to relate to, I find. But anyway, so Lolita, that is what that film is about. I've seen it the once. I have no plan to return to it. And I did think about, before doing this show, should I watch each film again? And I just thought, it defeats the purpose. Because I found that I've proved myself wrong many times recently. When I've been in the charity shop, I've seen a film that I've owned before, and I didn't like it. And I thought, should I have another look at it? And not one so far have I looked at again and thought, I made the wrong decision when I got rid of it all those years ago. It's in the box set. That's where it's going to stay. 1964, Dr. Strangelove came out. Now, that is probably, many people regard it as Kubrick's masterpiece. It's a political satire, black comedy. It's described out at the top of its unique Wikipedia page here. Peter Sellers plays a variety of roles in it. He plays the president and he plays this guy, Dr. Strangelove. And I thought Peter Sellers was good as Inspector Clouseau, but anything else that I've seen him in, I don't really know what all the fuss is about. So, you know, that might be sacrilege to some people, but that's just my opinion. It's essentially what happens, as I recall, is Dr. Strangelove suggests to the President of the United States that they bomb the Soviet Union. They go to bomb it, and then they change their mind, and they try to stop the bombing from happening and what have you. And I found it quite tiresome. Some people will say it's a great satire and this, that and the other, but for me, it's not one that I would be going back to. So it's been quite pointless, isn't it, this study, because I'm not a great fan of what's been said so far, really. Nothing I plan to look at again. But we go on to 1968, 2001 A Space Odyssey, which marked Kubrick's return to colour film after 1960's Spartacus, and his remaining films would all be filmed in colour also. Now, 2001 Space Odyssey, for me, this is one of Kubrick's real classics, one of the two. And it's a very weird film. It's a space film. You know, you think, oh, space, you think Star Wars. Well, you'll be disappointed because it hasn't got all the action of a Star Wars film. But it starts off with the dawn of man and some monolith appearing before some apes, and how, you know, ape men, I suppose, you know, and all these sorts of different things. And then suddenly we're in space. We go from a monolith with a load of dawn of men people running around, scratching, making funny noises and things like that, to this space age film with really impressive looking spacecraft, which were probably all done by models back at the time in 1968, and with a backdrop of classical music. And I'm not a big fan of classical music, but the film is so beautifully shot that you're sort of mesmerized by it just looking at it. You know, it's sort of like a Koyaanisqatsi Scutsy type of thing, where you can just be looking at the visuals, and even if there's no dialogue, you're sort of mesmerized by what's going on. The story itself, from what I understand it, and I might be completely misinterpreting what was going on, but you see a space crew, they're on the way somewhere, and the computer decides to do what it wants to do, which is not what the crew want to do. And so the crew try to override the computer, and consequently they end up in a dispute with the computer. And one of them ends up in a room somewhere at some point and sees this monolith that started off at the dawn of man at the start of the film, and then you see him as a baby in a womb, and that's it. So it's a wonderful film to look at. It's got some interesting things going on and what have you in space. So any Kubrick purists out there will say I've completely not done it justice, but I don't want to give it away. This is a film I would look at again, and it is one that I would, not in the immediate future, but at some point, I know I'm going to run out of new things to look at. Because I have a rule, and that is I don't generally look at anything after 2013, because the nature of the content back there, from then on, I've noticed both if it was television content in the UK, film content out of Hollywood, it became much more about the societal messages they wanted to promote than about the content. And that annoys me. Some people are doing it earlier than that. People will have their own opinions. But whilst that's disappointing in some ways, that you feel, well, I can't look at any new content, at least you've got a window of time in which to look at. And that's the way I see it, and I'm really running out of new things to look at. So 2001, A Space Odyssey. We move on to 1971, A Clockwork Orange. I referred to it earlier when I talked about Philip Stone playing Malcolm McDowell, the protagonist of the film's father in the film. And it's from an Anthony Burgess novel. And the story is you've got these violent young thugs which are led by Malcolm McDowell. And can't remember his name in the film, but they dress up in top hat and tails, and it's set in the so-called future. But it's one of those films, the futuristic world that's portrayed in 1971 is nothing like how the future has panned out, unless it's still yet to happen, you know, the visuals that they use and what have you. And it starts off with all the different nasty things that they get up to, and there's a horrible rape scene in there and different things like that that I really didn't enjoy. But contrary to what a lot of people think, especially here in the UK, the film was not banned. What happened was indeed there was calls in the press for it to be banned because Leeds United football supporters, the hooligan element, started dressing up like these characters in A Clockwork Orange and beating people up. And they said, oh, this can't be allowed, you know, they've got it from this film and what have you. Kubrick was visited by the police, and there's a scene in the film where a writer, a reclusive writer, is visited by these thugs and beaten up to the point of being crippled by them. And the police made the point, you're somewhat reclusive, you live in the middle of nowhere, Hertfordshire here, with your family, don't you? And the claim was that he withdrew the film in the UK, and he withdrew it. He said that it would not be available during his lifetime. Now, there are two schools of thought. There's a school of thought that says because of the haranguing he got in the press of what he considered a piece of art, he thought, well, the British public don't deserve to see this film that I've done. The other school of thought is, well, if we've already got people dressing up as characters in the film and beating people up, will it get to a stage that they're going to come after me living as a recluse like I do as the subversive writer in the film? So that was the kind of, you know, the two schools of thought there. One might be right, neither might be right. I don't know. That's what I heard. But in the end, the thugs, one of them at least, is given the opportunity to cut their prison sentence by agreeing to a new treatment, which would let him go free pretty much straight away, because it's designed to make him allergic, if you like, probably the wrong word, to violence. And what they do is they keep subjecting him to scenes of violence, and at the start he's really enjoying it, and then it just gets too much and he just wants it turned off and what have you. And they have a bit where they they have to hold his eyelids open with these metal rods. And in real life, Malcolm McDowell, he actually, his corneas got scratched by these, and it was quite, had to seek, I believe, medical attention for this. So it was really, you know, when you see things in films, they're not always as safe as you get to hear. I remember the actor Peter Jason in the audio commentary of Prince of Darkness with John Carpenter, the director. He talked about a scene in which he whacked a door in that film, and he's in, on a cold day, that shoulder that he hit it with, it still acts up on a cold day. And he just said, this is the sort of thing as an actor, you pick up these little injuries over the years that you act. And the Tobias Beecher character, played by Lee Turgeson in the television series Oz by Tom Fontana, in the first episode, when he's sent to prison, he's banging his hand against the cell door really hard, and that's the scene. And he claims to have lost feeling in part of that hand after doing that scene ever since. So, you know, maybe being an actor is not quite as glamorous as it's cooked up to be, is it? But anyway, going back to Clockwork Orange, he has this treatment. It turns out a couple of his people that were thugs in his gang have become police officers, of all things. And he gets out, and it shows about what happens in his life when he gets out. And that goes on for a bit, and I'm not going to give that game away. But again, if you've not seen it, it's a film worth watching. There's some violent scenes in it that I really, you know, when I was a kid, we all wanted the video nasties, me and the people I hung around with. Maybe we were just weird, but if a film had been bad, we wanted to see it. Whether it was A Clockwork Orange that we mistakenly thought was bad, then not withdrawn by Kubrick, whether it was The Texas Chainsaw Massacre, all these sort of things, it's that thing that comes about when the government bans something, everyone wants to read it. When Margaret Thatcher banned the Peter Wright book Spycatcher on the grounds of national security, loads of people went out to buy it. And I remember the satirical program Spitting Image made a joke that people thought they were going to get a load of inside stuff, but it actually was just about an old spy moaning about his pension rights. So that was what the basis of the story was largely about. But for whatever reason, she decided to ban it. When you ban things, you can inevitably make them more popular. And that is what happened in not just the case of A Clockwork Orange, but in many other cases. I wouldn't go to watch it again, but if you haven't seen it, it is a classic film. There are some disturbing scenes in it, but as I do with so many horror films, I look away during that point. Barry Lyndon, 1975. This is a period drama. This is sort of, I don't know, would it be something like a Downton Abbey type of thing? According to, I've only seen it once, I will not be watching it again. I cannot stand period dramas. I really don't like them at all. The concluding line from the opening paragraph on the Barry Lyndon Wikipedia page reads as follows. The film recounts the early exploits and later unravelling of an 18th century Irish rogue and gold digger who marries a rich widow in order to attempt to climb the social ladder and assume her late husband's aristocratic position. All I remember in there is there's a duel, I believe, between Barry Lyndon, who's played by Ryan O'Neill, and Leonard Rossiter out of Rising Damp. And, you won't really pair those two together. It's a bit like when I saw Thora Hird acting with Marlon Brando in that Michael Winner film from 1970, the something or other, my mind goes blank. But if you look up Michael Winner's filmography or Marlon Brando around the 1970 mark, seeing him acting with Thora Hird out of Last of the Summer Wine is really something. So anyway, not into these sort of period dramas, although Leonard Rossiter, not trying to do the guy down, he also played a small role in 2001 as well, so he is an actor that's appeared in two of Stanley Kubrick's films. But Barry Lyndon, for me, it might be some people's favourite. I believe that what happened in there, that there was, he needed to get a certain lens for a certain camera in order to film the lighting properly. And there was a story around that I believe there was something whereby he actually, something that Kubrick did do, is the submarine scenes when they're in the... submarines in a hangar. I know aircraft are in a hangar, but, you know, where it's in, you know, parked up, shall we say, in a building, whatever it's called. The production designer, Ken Adam, I believe is his name, from the Spy Who Loved Me film, and I think he did other James Bond films, he couldn't light it properly, and Kubrick lived in London. All the Bond films were shot probably the same studios as Kubrick used. You know, you had the studio in Bournemouth, Pinewood, Twickenham, all this sort of thing. And he asked him if he'd help him out, and he came down and helped him out. And so the scenes of the submarines in The Spy Who Loved Me were actually directed by Kubrick. There you go. So, okay, that's Barry Lyndon. And then we go on to what I consider my favourite Kubrick film, and that is 1980's The Shining. Now, this is a proper horror film, and it's a longer film, and it's got an interesting history to it, because the American film is 146 minutes, so that's nearly 2.5 hours. Whereas the European version is 119 minutes, which is a minute short of 2 hours. So why the extra scenes? Well, I've got both versions, and it's best described as the American version has scenes that... the additional scenes are generally scenes that occur outside of the hotel, because the film is about a guy with his wife and young child who takes on the role of being a caretaker at a hotel that's in a remote part of the mountains in Colorado that's going to get snowed in for the winter, so it can only open in summer months, spring, summer. And he agrees to take the role on because he's going to do some writing while he's up there, and he has to basically, you know, if a window blows in or something like that, he has to fix it. He has to make sure that, you know, the hotel's not left completely abandoned, so the owners turn up and the roof's fallen in or something like that. You know, he's there to monitor the situation, as it were, and carry out any repairs one man can do, and presumably, if it's a big job, get the contractors in to deal with it. While he's there, weird things start to happen to him. It's based on the Stephen King novel of the same name, although it's only really loosely based upon the novel. Stephen King had very little regard for the film because there was very little of his novel was represented in it. And subsequently, a television miniseries was made of the film that Stephen King gave his approval of, I believe, about 10 years after this in 1990. But I've never seen that. It is a genuinely creepy film. It's not... there are some bloody scenes in it, but for me, a horror film, I imagine that there is a almost like a scientific textbook on how you do a horror film, how many times you do a fake scare, you do a real scare, all these different things to keep the viewer interested. What really absorbs you in this film, though, is the acting. I think it's Jack Nicholson's best film. People would say Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest is best film. I think this is his best acted film. I think he does a fantastic job. He keeps you absorbed, even when he's talking to the manager of the hotel when he arrives before the manager leaves. So he gets introduced to the hotel and you see his interview there and stuff. You're mesmerised on the screen. I remember Quentin Tarantino talking about NYPD Blue season 1 with David Caruso, and he said, was anybody looking at the other actor that he played opposite, whose name I can't quite remember, but he went on to pretty much be the lead because Caruso left at the start of series 2 due to contractual difficulties. But you were just rooted to this guy, and I think David Caruso is a fine actor. People say he's not in the league of Jack Nicholson, but the premise remains the same. You were rooted to that person when you were watching them on the screen. And the film itself is one you can watch again and again. There are other aspects to the film that I only became aware of. There are claims that the film is actually documenting something very different to a horror story of a guy in a hotel that spooky things starts to happen to. But I've covered that in other shows. I want this to remain as just... about the film as it's presented. Do you see what I mean? If you want to look up other things, look up The Shining Code, look up Secrets of The Shining. There's also supposed to be... people claim there's hidden messages in this film. They claim there's hidden messages in 2001. There's another documentary, Kubrick's Odyssey. You can find all these hidden messages that are claimed in there. They may be true, they may be not. I'm trying to focus on the film as you see it, what you get from it. And I would never have seen those hidden messages if they weren't pointed out to me. So I'm just looking at it now as a classic horror film. I think it's a classic horror film, one of the best. For me, it's Kubrick's best film, and it's Jack Nicholson's best film. And you've got other people in there that do. The kid in there who plays Danny is just amazing. The Scatman Crothers character, he just plays it so well. Dick Halloran is the role he plays. He also was one of the orderlies in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, and it's my understanding that he was personal friends with Jack Nicholson, and that was part of the reason that he got him into that film. But they all just do such a wonderful job in this film. And yeah, it is marketed as a horror film, and there are some creepy things in it, but I would call it an intelligent horror film. You know, it's not blood and guts, gratuitous, flying all over the place, all this sort of hostile type nonsense. This is really a thriller, and it's got some disturbing scenes in it which add to the thriller. So there you go. Let's move on to the penultimate film of Stanley Kubrick, and that is 1987's Full Metal Jacket. For me, when I first saw it, and still today, this is like two halves of a film spliced together that weren't finished. It really, essentially, you've got the first half of a film, you've got a load of people that are going to be going off to the Vietnam War being trained. And that's the best part of the film. There's a foul-mouthed gallery sergeant in it who was played by the guy that was actually only the technical advisor. So you're going to have a different actor playing it. That was Arlie Ermey. But he pushed and pushed for the role, and he got the role. And he just... I don't like gratuitous swearing, but it's done, certainly when I was younger. And a lot of what he says, it's so bizarre, it makes one laugh, to the extent that a character in the film, played by Vincent D'Onofrio, he laughs when this guy's going on his swearing tirades. And the gallery sergeant, Hartman, I believe, played by Arlie Ermey, doesn't like that at all. And consequently, Vincent D'Onofrio becomes the guy in the class that gets picked on by him. It doesn't help the fact that he is overweight, and so he struggles anyway. And consequently, you've got this back and forth between the two of them, and over time it becomes very... Excuse me, I'll just turn that off. Sorry, I thought I'd unplugged that before the show. But anyway... It becomes quite a sad spectacle of the way that this guy is being treated. But then after they leave the training centre, they're in Vietnam, and I don't remember much of that, but things go on in Vietnam. But it just seems like it would have been better if it had just ended at the training centre, in my opinion, and not gone on to Vietnam. So, but it's a good film. I still recommend seeing it. When I was young, you know, things like swearing and all that, as you get older, things like that become tiresome and really not so interesting stuff. I don't know, watching it again, I've got no interest in watching it again. So far, the only ones that I would watch again of Kubrick's are 2001 and The Shining. But this is regarded as... I remember seeing the video case in a video shop, because it came out in, 1987, and it was acclaimed by critics around the world as the best war movie ever made. Well, I don't believe that for a moment, because it's not really a war movie. Half of it is. So again, it's a sort of an oddity there. But that takes us on to Kubrick's last film, Eyes Wide Shut, which was actually released after his death. I got it wrong. It's 1999 it came out. And this story, I mean, this film is over 2.5 hours long, 159 minutes. And it's a bit of a non-event for me. And what basically happens is you've got a wealthy couple, the man's a doctor, the woman, I forget what she does, it's played by husband and wife at the time, Tom Cruise and Nicole Kidman. And they're talking about sex. They're young, successful people, and they're talking about sexual fantasies. And then things go on, and I don't want to give the game away. Cruz runs into an old friend of his who tells him that he gets paid to play the piano at a very famous, an exclusive, expensive house, but for a party. But he has to wear a blindfold all the time. And Cruz ends up managing to get into that party, and he's discovered that he shouldn't be there. And he's revealed and what have you. And then he sort of went there because he heard that all these sort of, you know, this is like a sex party for the elites and stuff like that that goes on. He was curious. And his wife went off and did something as well outside of the marriage. And then they both have bad experiences, and they come back together to realise that, you know, messing about with sex is not really conducive to a good marriage, and we should be happy with the fact we have each other, which I think, for me, a good message of the film and what a lot of people could learn from is, you know, life is not all about sex, which is what we're being told by the main... I mean... there's a story that was floating around the mainstream media in the last week that I thought about bringing up on my new show, I'm Talking to You, but I just didn't because it just disgusted me so much. And the headline was something like, I'm in my 50s, I divorced my husband of many years for a sexless marriage, and now I'm having wonderful sex with men in their 20s. And is this progress? What life is about, just, oh, let's all have sex. It's just, it's all just what's thrown at you now. And when I think of Kubrick, he married his wife Christiana before he really became famous, and he stayed married to her for the rest of his life. And it makes you wonder if he chose this story in sort of honour of the fact that of their marriage, that, you know, so few people in Hollywood stay together in a long marriage. They all seem to be, most of them seem to be jumping from one to another, but it's quite refreshing when you see a couple that does actually stay together. So that is the story of Eyes Wide Shut. There's many claims that, oh, you know, Kubrick, because he died of a heart attack, he was only 70, and, you know, there are claims that the studio, it revealed a lot of what the elites got up to, and the studio was forced to cut these things out. I've not seen evidence to that, and when you actually watch the film, it is a story, and you would have to ask yourself, where are these bits that they cut out? What would they be revealing? What are they adding to it? I just find it a very boring, long drawn out story. So from my perspective, it's not really worth looking at. I certainly won't be going back to it. I did once go back to it when I heard all these claims that there was supposed to be additional material, and it's supposed to reveal all these different things. I mean, it is wonderfully shot. If you've not seen it, I would recommend looking at it, because the scenes inside the house and the way it's done, and it's very slow paced, but it is mesmerising. It really draws you in. But the ones, I think I saw it again, and that's pretty much enough for me. So I'm sure this is now enough for you. So that being said, what I presented to you today, it's not the subject I'm best known for, but after having had my God-given right to free speech stolen from me by the very people who are supposed to protect it, it has been a joy to be able to speak freely on this subject today. It is not until I did it that I realised how much I missed it. Okay, if you enjoyed this episode of Andrew Carrington Hitchcock Presents and have the financial wherewithal to do so, then please support the show by clicking the blue donate button at andrewcarringtonhitchcock.com. The more donations I get, the more shows you get. And in the meantime, thank you for listening, and bye for now.